This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Kingdom of Ash, written by Sarah J. Maas, performed by Elizabeth Evans.
The Prince. He had been hunting for her since the moment she was taken from him, his mate. He barely remembered his own name, and only recalled it because his three companions spoke it while they searched for her across violent and dark seas, through ancient and slumbering forests, over storm-swept mountains already buried in snow. He stopped long enough to feed his body and allow his companions a few hours of sleep. Were it not for them, he would have flown off, soared far and wide. But he would need the strength of their blades and magic, would need their cunning and wisdom before this was through, before he faced the Dark Queen who had torn into his innermost self, stealing his mate long before she had been locked in an iron coffin. And after he was done with her, after that, then he'd take on the cold-blooded gods themselves, hell-bent on destroying what might remain of his mate. So he stayed with his companions, even as the days passed. Then the weeks, then months. Still he searched. Still he hunted for her on every dusty and forgotten road. And sometimes, he spoke along the bond between them, sending his soul on the wind to wherever she was held captive, entombed. I will find you. The Princess. The iron smothered her. It had snuffed out the fire in her veins, as surely as if the flames had been doused. She could hear the water, even in the iron box, even with the iron mask and chains adorning her like ribbons of silk. The roaring, the endless rushing of water over stone. It filled the gaps between her screaming. A sliver of island in the heart of a mist-veiled river, little more than a smooth slab of rock amid the rapids and falls. That's where they'd put her, stored her, in a stone temple built for some forgotten god, as she would likely be forgotten. It was better than the alternative, to be remembered for her utter failure, if there would be anyone left to remember her, if there would be anyone left at all. She would not allow it, that failure. She would not tell them what they wished to know. No matter how often her screams drowned out the raging river, no matter how often the snap of her bones cleaved through the bellowing rapids, she had tried to keep track of the days, but she did not know how long they had kept her in that iron box, how long they had forced her to sleep, lulled into oblivion by the sweet smoke they'd poured in while they traveled here, to this island, this temple of pain. She did not know how long the gaps lasted between her screaming and waking, between the pain ending and starting anew. Days, months, years. They bled together, as her own blood often slithered over the stone floor and into the river itself. A princess who was to live for 1,000 years. Longer. That had been her gift. It was now her curse. Another curse to bear, as heavy as the one placed upon her long before her birth. To sacrifice her very self to right an ancient wrong. To pay another's debt to the gods who had found their world, become trapped in it, and then ruled it. She did not feel the warm hand of the goddess who had blessed and damned her with such terrible power. She wondered if that goddess of light and flame even cared that she now lay trapped within the iron box, or if the immortal had transferred her attentions to another, to the king who might offer himself in her stead and, in yielding his life, spare their world. The gods did not care who paid the debt. So she knew they would not come for her, save her. So she did not bother praying to them. But she still told herself the story, still sometimes imagined that the river sang it to her, that the darkness living within the sealed coffin sang it to her as well. once upon a time, in a land long since burned to ash, there lived a young princess who loved her kingdom. Down she would drift, deep into that darkness, into the sea of flame. Down so deep that when the whip cracked, when bone sundered, she sometimes did not feel it. Most times she did. It was during those infinite hours that she would fix her stare on her companion. Not the queen's hunter, who could draw out pain like a musician coaxing a melody from an instrument, but the massive white wolf, chained by invisible bonds. Forced to witness this, there were some days when she could not stand to look at the wolf, when she had come so close, too close, to breaking, and only the story had kept her from doing so. Once upon a time, in a land long since burned to ash, there lived a young princess who loved her kingdom. Words she had spoken to a prince. Once, long ago, a prince of ice and wind, a prince who had been hers and she his, long before the bond between their souls became known to them. It was upon him that the task of protecting that once glorious kingdom now fell. The prince whose scent was kissed with pine and snow, the scent of that kingdom she had loved with her heart of wildfire. Even when the Dark Queen presided over the hunter's ministrations, the princess thought of him, held on to his memory as if it were a rock in the raging river. The Dark Queen, with a spider's smile, tried to wield it against her. In the obsidian webs she wove, the illusions and dreams she spun at the culmination of each breaking point, the queen tried to twist the memory of him as a key into her mind. They were blurring. The lies and truths and memories. Sleep and the blackness in the iron coffin. The days bound to the stone altar in the center of the room, or hanging from a hook in the ceiling, or strung up between chains anchored into the stone wall. It was all beginning to blur, like ink and water. So she told herself the story. The darkness and the flame deep within her whispered it too. And she sang it back to them. Locked in that coffin, hidden on an island within the heart of a river, the princess recited the story, over and over, and let them unleash an eternity of pain upon her body. Once upon a time, in a land long since burned to ash, there lived a young princess who loved her kingdom. Part 1. Armies and Allies. Chapter 1. The snows had come early. Even for Terrison, the first of the autumnal flurries had barreled in far ahead of their usual arrival. Adian Ash River wasn't entirely sure it was a blessing. But if it kept Morath's legions from their doorstep just a little longer, he'd get on his knees to thank the gods. Even if those same gods threatened everything he loved. If beings from another world could be considered gods at all. Adian supposed he had more important things to contemplate anyway. In the 2 weeks since he'd been reunited with his bane, they'd seen no sign of Erewhon's forces, either terrestrial or airborne. The thick snow had begun falling barely 3 days after his return, hindering the already slow process of transporting the troops from their assembled armada to the Bane's sweeping camp on the plain of Theralis. The ships had sailed up the Florine, right to Orinth's doorstep, banners of every color flapping in the brisk wind off the staghorns. The cobalt and gold of Wendlin, the black and crimson of Ansel of Briarcliff, the shimmering silver of the Whitethorn Royals and their many cousins. The silent assassins, scattered throughout the fleet, had no banner, though none was needed to identify them. Not with their pale clothes and assortment of beautiful, vicious weapons. The ships would soon rejoin the rear guard left at the Florine's mouth and patrol the coast from Ilium to Surya. But the foot soldiers, most hailing from Crown Prince Galen Ash River's forces, would go to the front. A front that now lay buried under several feet of snow, with more coming. Hidden above a narrow mountain pass in the Staghorns behind Owlsbrook, Adian scowled at the heavy sky. His pale furs blended him into the gray and white of the rocky outcropping, a hood concealing his golden hair, and keeping him warm. Many of Galen's troops had never seen snow, thanks to Wendland's temperate climate. The Whitethorn Royals and their smaller force were hardly better off. So Adian had left Killian, his most trusted commander, in charge of ensuring that they were as warm as could be managed. They were far from home, fighting for a queen they did not know or perhaps even believe in. That frigid cold would sap spirits and sprout dissent faster than the howling wind charging between these peaks. A flicker of movement on the other side of the pass caught Adian's eye, visible only because he knew where to look. She'd camouflaged herself better than he had. But Lysandra had the advantage of wearing a coat that had been bred for these mountains. Not that he'd said that to her, or so much as glanced at her when they'd departed on this scouting mission. Aelin, apparently, had secret business in Eldris and had left a note with Galen and her new allies to account for her disappearance, which allowed Lysandra to accompany them on this task. No one had noticed, in the nearly 2 months they'd been maintaining this ruse, that the Queen of Fire had not an ember to show for it, or that she and the shapeshifter never appeared in the same place. And no one, not the silent assassins of the Red Desert, or Galen Ash River, or the troops that Ansel of Briarcliff had sent with the Armada ahead of the bulk of her army, had picked up the slight tells that did not belong to Aelin at all. Nor had they noted the brand on the queen's wrist, that no matter what skin she wore, Lysandra could not change. She did a fine job of hiding the brand with gloves or long sleeves. And if a glimmer of scarred skin ever showed, it could be excused as part of the manacle markings that remained. The fake scars she'd also added, right where Aelin had them. Along with the laugh and wicked grin, the swagger and stillness. Adian could barely stand to look at her, talk to her. He only did so because he had to uphold this ruse too, to pretend that he was her faithful cousin, her fearless commander who would lead her and Terrasen to victory, however unlikely. So he played the part, one of many he'd donned in his life. Yet the moment Lysandra changed her golden hair for dark tresses, Ash River eyes for emerald, he stopped acknowledging her existence. Some days, the Terrasen knot tattooed on his chest, the names of his queen and fledgling court woven amongst it, felt like a brand. Her name especially. He'd only brought her on this mission to make it easier, safer. There were other lives beyond his at risk. And though he could have unloaded this scouting task to a unit within the Bane, he'd needed the action. It had taken over a month to sail from Eelway with their newfound allies, dodging Morath's fleet around Rifthold, and then these past 2 weeks to move inland. They had seen little to no combat, only a few roving bands of Otterlanian soldiers, no Volg amongst them, that had been dealt with quickly. Adian doubted Erewhon was waiting until spring, doubted the quiet had anything to do with the weather. He'd discussed it with his men, and with Darrow and the other lords a few days ago. Erewhon was likely waiting until the dead of winter, when mobility would be hardest for Terrasen's army. When Adian soldiers would be weak from months in the snow, their bodies stiff with cold. Even the king's fortune that Aelin had schemed and won for them this past spring couldn't prevent that. Yes, food and blankets and clothes could be purchased, but when the supply lines were buried under snow, what good were they then? All the gold in Irelia couldn't stop the slow, steady leaching of strength caused by months in a winter camp, exposed to Terrasen's merciless elements. Darrow and the other lords didn't believe his claim that Erewhon would strike in deep winter. Or believe Wren, when the Lord of Owlsbrook voiced his agreement. Erewhon was no fool, they claimed. Despite his aerial legion of witches, even Volg foot soldiers could not cross snow when it was 10 feet deep. They'd decided that Erewhon would wait until spring. Yet Adian was taking no chances. Neither was Prince Galen, who had remained silent in that meeting, but sought Adian afterward to add his support. They had to keep their troops warm and fed, keep them trained and ready to march at a moment's notice. This scouting mission, if Wren's information proved correct, would help their cause. Nearby, a bowstring groaned, barely audible over the wind. Its tip and shaft had been painted white, and were now barely visible as it aimed with deadly precision toward the pass opening. Adian caught Wren Owlsbrook's eye from where the young lord was concealed amongst the rocks, his arrow ready to fly. Cloaked in the same white and gray furs as Adian, a pale scarf over his mouth, Wren was little more than a pair of dark eyes and the hint of a slashing scar. Adian motioned to wait. Barely glancing toward the shapeshifter across the pass, Aelin conveyed the same order. Let their enemies draw closer. Crunching snow mingled with labored breathing. Right on time. Adian knocked an arrow to his own bow and ducked lower on the outcropping. As Wren's scout had claimed when she'd rushed into Adian's war tent 5 days ago, there were 6 of them. They did not bother to blend into the snow and rock. Their dark fur, shaggy and strange, might as well have been a beacon against the glaring white of the staghorns. But it was the reek of them, carried on a swift wind, that told Adian enough. Volg. No sign of a collar on anyone in the small party. Any hint of a ring concealed by their thick gloves. Apparently, even demon-infested vermin could get cold. Or their mortal hosts did. Their enemies moved deeper into the throat of the pass. Wren's arrow held steady. Leave one alive, Adian had ordered before they'd taken their positions. It had been a lucky guess that they'd choose this pass, a half-forgotten back door into Terrasen's low-lying lands. Only wide enough for 2 horses to ride abreast. It had long been ignored by conquering armies and the merchants seeking to sell their wares in the hinterlands beyond the staghorns. What dwelled out there? Who dared make a living beyond any recognized border? Adian didn't know. Just as he didn't know why these soldiers had ventured so far into the mountains. But he'd find out soon enough. The demon company passed beneath them, and Adian and Wren shifted to reposition their bows. A straight shot down into the skull. He picked his mark. Adian's nod was the only signal before his arrow flew. Black blood was still steaming in the snow when the fighting stopped. It had lasted only a few minutes, just a few, after Wren and Adian's arrows found their targets, and Lysandra had leaped from her perch to shred 3 others, and rip the muscles from the calves of the 6th and sole surviving member of the company. The demon moaned as Adian stalked toward him, the snow at the man's feet now jet black, his legs in ribbons, like scraps of a banner in the wind. Lysandra sat near his head, her moss-stained ebony and her green eyes fixed on the man's pale face. Needle-sharp claws gleamed from her massive paws. Behind them, Wren checked the others for signs of life. His sword rose and fell, decapitating them before the frigid air could render them too stiff to hack through.
Traitorous filth.
The demon seethed at Adian, narrow face curdling with hate. The reek of him stuffed itself up Adian's nostrils, coating his senses like oil. Adian drew the knife at his side, the long, wicked dagger Rowan Whitethorn had gifted him, and smiled grimly.
This can go quickly, if you're smart.
The Volg soldier spat on Adian's snow-crusted boots. Owlsbrook Castle had stood with the staghorns at its back and Oakwald at its feet for over 500 years.
pacing before the roaring fire ablaze in one of its many oversized hearths, Adian could count the marks of every brutal winter upon the gray stones. Could feel the weight of the castle's storied history on those stones, too. The years of valor and service, when these halls had been full of singing and warriors. And the long years of sorrow that followed. Wren had claimed a worn, tufted armchair set to one side of the fire, his forearms braced on his thighs as he stared into the flame. They'd arrived late last night, and even Adian had been too drained from the trek through snowbound Oakwald to take the grand tour. And after what they'd done this afternoon, he doubted he'd muster the energy to do so now. The once great hall was hushed and dim beyond their fire. And above them, faded tapestries and crests from the Alsbrook family's bannermen swayed in the draft creeping through the high windows that lined one side of the chamber. An assortment of birds nested in the rafters, hunkered down against the lethal cold beyond the keep's ancient walls. And amongst them, a green-eyed falcon listened to every word.
"If Erewhon's searching for a way into Terrasen," Wren said at last, "the mountains would be foolish."
He frowned toward the discarded trays of food they'd devoured minutes ago. Hearty mutton stew and roasted root vegetables. Most of it bland, but it had been hot.
"The land does not forgive easily out here. He'd lose countless troops to the elements alone."
"Erewhon does nothing without reason," Adian countered. "The easiest route to Terrasen would be up through the farmlands on the northern roads. It's where anyone would expect him to march, either there or to launch his forces from the coast."
"Or both, by land and sea."
Adian nodded. Erewhon had spread his net wide in his desire to stomp out what resistance had arisen on this continent. Gone was the guise of Otterlin's empire. From Eelway to Otterlin's northern border, from the shores of the great ocean to the towering wall of mountains that cleaved their continent in two. The Volg King's shadow grew every day. Adian doubted that Erewhon would stop before he clamped black collars around all their necks. And if Erewhon attained the other two word keys, if he could open the word gate at will and unleash hordes of Volg from his own realm, perhaps even enslave armies from other worlds and wield them for conquest, there would be no chance of stopping him, in this world or any other. All hope of preventing that horrible fate now lay with Dorian Havilliard and Manon Blackbeak. Where they'd gone these months, what had befallen them, Adian hadn't heard a whisper, which he supposed was a good sign. Their survival lay in secrecy. Adian said,
"So, for Erewhon to waste a scouting party to find small mountain passes seems unwise."
He scratched at his stubble-coated cheek. They'd left before dawn yesterday, and he'd opted for sleep over a shave.
"It doesn't make sense, strategically. The witches can fly, so sending scouts to learn the pitfalls of the terrain is of little use. But if the information is for terrestrial armies, squeezing forces through small passes like that would take months, not to mention risk the weather."
"Their scout just kept laughing,"
said Wren, shaking his head. His shoulder-length black hair moved with him.
"What are we missing here? What aren't we seeing?"
In the firelight, the slashing scar down his face was starker. A reminder of the horrors Wren had endured, and the ones his family hadn't survived.
"It could be to keep us guessing, to make us reposition our forces."
Adian braced a hand on the mantle, the warm stone seeping into his still-chilled skin. Wren had indeed readied the Bane the months Adian had been away, working closely with Killian to position them as far south from Orinth as Darrow's leash would allow. Which, it turned out, was barely beyond the foothills lining the southernmost edge of the plain of Thoralis. Wren had since yielded control to Adian, though the Lord of Alsbrook's reunion with Aelin had been frosty. As cold as the snow whipping outside this keep, to be exact.
Lysandra had played the role well, mastering Aelin's guilt and impatience. And since then, wisely avoiding any situation where they might talk about the past. Not that Ren had demonstrated a desire to reminisce about the years before Terrasen's fall, or the events of last winter. Adian could only hope that Erewhon also remained unaware that they no longer had the Firebringer in their midst. What Terrasen's own troops would say or do when they realized Aelin's flame would not shield them in battle, he didn't want to consider.
It could also be a true maneuver that we were lucky enough to discover, Ren mused.
So, do we risk moving troops to the passes?
There are some already in the Staghorns behind Orinth, and on the northern plains beyond it.
A clever move on Ren's part, to convince Darrow to let him station part of the Bane behind Orinth, should Erewhon sail north and attack from there. He'd put nothing past the bastard.
I don't want the Bane spread too thin, said Adian, studying the fire.
So different, this flame.
So different from Aelin's fire. As if the one before him were a ghost compared to the living thing that was his queen's magic.
And we still don't have enough troops to spare.
Even with Aelin's desperate, bold maneuvering, the allies she'd won didn't come close to the full might of Morath. And all that gold she'd amassed did little to buy them more, not when there were few left to even entice to join their cause.
Aelin didn't seem too concerned when she flitted off to Eldris,
Ren murmured. For a moment, Adian was on a spit of blood-soaked sand, an iron box. Maeve had whipped her and put her in a veritable coffin, and sailed off to Mala knew where, an immortal sadist with them.
Aelin,
said Adian, dredging up a drawl as best he could, even as the lie choked him.
Has her own plans that she'll only tell us about when the time is right.
Ren said nothing. And though the queen Ren believed had returned was an illusion, Adian added,
everything she does is for Terrasen.
He'd said such horrible things to her that day she'd taken down the Ilken.
Where are our allies? He'd demanded.
He was still trying to forgive himself for it. For any of it. All that he had was this one chance to make it right. To do as she'd asked, and save their kingdom. Ren glanced to the twin swords he'd discarded on the ancient table behind them.
She still left.
Not for Eldris, but 10 years ago.
We've all made mistakes this past decade.
The gods knew Adian had plenty to atone for. Ren tensed, as if the choices that haunted him had nipped at his back.
I never told her,
Adian said quietly, so that the falcons sitting in the rafters might not hear.
About the opium den in Rifthold?
About the fact that Ren had known the owner, and had frequented the woman's establishment plenty before the night Adian and Kaol had hauled in a nearly unconscious Ren to hide from the king's men.
You can be a real prick. You know that?
Ren's voice turned hoarse.
I'd never use that against you.
Adian held the young lord's raging dark stare. Let Ren feel the dominance simmering within his own.
What I meant to say before you flew off the handle,
he added when Ren's mouth opened again,
was that Aelin offered you a place in this court without knowing that part of your past.
A muscle flickered in Ren's jaw.
But even if she had, Ren, she still would have made that offer.
Ren studied the stone floor beneath their boots.
There is no court.
Darrow can scream it all he wants, but I beg to differ.
Adian slid into the armchair across from Ren's. If Ren truly backed Aelin, with Elide Lochan now returned, and Sol and Ravi of Surya likely to support her, it gave his queen 3 votes in her favor, against the 4 opposing her. There was little hope that Lysandra's vote as Lady of Caravere would be recognized. The shifter had not asked to see the land that was to be her home if they survived this war, had only changed into a falcon on the trek here and flown off for a while, When she'd returned, she'd said nothing, though her green eyes had been bright. No, Caravere would not be recognized as a territory. Not until Aelin took up her throne. Until Lysandra instead was crowned queen, if his own did not return. She would return. She had to. A door opened at the far end of the hall, followed by rushing light steps. He rose a heartbeat before a joyous, "Adian!" sang over the stones. Evangeline was beaming, clad head to toe in green woolen clothes bordered with white fur, her red-gold hair hanging in two plaits, like the mountain girls of Terrasen. Her scars stretched wide as she grinned, and Adian threw open his arms just before she launched herself on him.
"They said you arrived late last night, but you left before first light, and I was worried I'd miss you again."
Adian pressed a kiss to the top of her head. "You look like you've grown a full foot since I last saw you." Evangeline's citrine eyes glowed as she glanced between him and Ren.
"Where's..."
A flash of light, and there she was. Shining. Lysandra seemed to be shining as she swept a cloak around her bare body, the garment left on a nearby chair for precisely this purpose. Evangeline hurled herself into the shifter's arms, half sobbing with joy. Evangeline's shoulders shook, and Lysandra smiled deeply and warmly, stroking the girl's head.
"You're well?"
For all the world, the shifter would have seemed calm, serene. But Adian knew her moods, her secret tells, knew that the slight tremor in her words was proof of the raging torrent beneath the beautiful surface.
"Oh, yes,"
Evangeline said, pulling away to beam toward Ren.
"He and Lord Murtaugh brought me here soon after. Fleetfoot's with him, by the way. Murtaugh, I mean. She likes him better than me because he sneaks her treats all day. She's fatter than a lazy house cat now."
Lysandra laughed, and Adian smiled. The girl had been well cared for. As if realizing it herself, Lysandra murmured to Ren, her voice a soft purr.
"Thank you."
Red tinted Ren's cheeks as he rose to his feet.
"I thought she'd be safer here than in the war camp. More comfortable, at least."
"Oh, it's the most wonderful place, Lysandra,"
Evangeline chirped, gripping Lysandra's hand between both of hers.
"Murtaugh even took me to Caravere one afternoon, before it started snowing, I mean. You must see it. The hills and rivers and pretty trees, all right up against the mountains. I thought I spied a ghost leopard hiding atop the rocks, but Murtaugh said it was a trick of my mind. But I swear it was one, even bigger than yours. And the house? It's the loveliest house I ever saw, with a walled garden in the back that Murtaugh says will be full of vegetables and roses in the summer."
For a heartbeat, Adian couldn't endure the emotion on Lysandra's face as Evangeline prattled off her grand plans for the estate. The pain of longing for a life that would likely be snatched away before she had a chance to claim it. Adian turned to Ren, the lord's gaze transfixed on Lysandra, as it had been whenever she'd taken her human form. Fighting the urge to clench his jaw, Adian said,
"You recognize Caravere, then?"
Evangeline continued her merry jabbering, but Lysandra's eyes slid toward them.
"Darrow is not Lord of Elsbrook,"
was all Ren said. Indeed. And who wouldn't want such a pretty neighbor? That is, when she wasn't living in Orinth under another's skin and crown, using Adian to sire a fake royal bloodline, little more than a stud to breed. Lysandra again nodded her thanks, and Ren's blush deepened. As if they hadn't spent all day trekking through snow and slaughtering Volg. As if the scent of gore didn't still cling to them. Indeed, Evangeline sniffed at the cloak Lysandra kept wrapped around herself and scowled.
"You smell terrible, all of you."
"Manners," Lysandra admonished, but laughed.
Evangeline put her hands on her hips in a gesture Adian had seen Aelin make so many times that his heart hurt to behold it.
You asked me to tell you if you ever smelled, especially your breath.
Lysandra smiled, and Adian resisted the tug on his own mouth.
So I did.
Evangeline yanked on Lysandra's hand, trying to haul the shifter down the hall.
You can share my room. There's a bathing chamber in there.
Lysandra conceded a step.
A fine room for a guest,
Adian muttered to Ren, his brows rising. It had to be one of the finest here to have its own bathing chamber. Ren ducked his head.
It belonged to Rose,
his oldest sister, who had been butchered along with Rollin, the middle Owlsbrook sibling, at the magic academy they'd attended. Near the border with Otterlin, the school had been directly in the path of invading troops. Even before magic fell, they would have had few defenses against 10,000 soldiers. Adian didn't let himself often remember the slaughter of Dvelin, that fabled school. How many children had been there? How none had escaped? Ren had been close to both his elder sisters, but to high-spirited Rose most of all.
She would have liked her,
Ren clarified, jerking his chin toward Evangeline. Scarred, Adian realized, as Ren was. The slash down Ren's face had been earned while escaping the butchering blocks. His parents' lives the cost of the diversion that got him and Murtaugh out. Evangeline's scars hailed from a different sort of escape, narrowly avoiding the hellish life her mistress endured. Adian didn't let himself often remember that fact, either. Evangeline continued pulling Lysandra away, oblivious to the conversation.
Why didn't you wake me when you arrived?
Adian didn't hear Lysandra's answer, as she let herself be led from the hall. Not as the shifter's gaze met his own. She had tried to speak with him these past 2 months. Many times. Dozens of times. He'd ignored her. And when they'd at last reached Terrison's shores, she'd given up. She had lied to him. Deceived him so thoroughly that any moment between them, any conversation, he didn't know what had been real. Didn't want to know. Didn't want to know if she'd meant any of it when he'd so stupidly left everything laid out before her. He'd believed this was his last hunt. That he'd be able to take his time with her, show her everything Terrison had to offer. Show her everything he had to offer, too. Lying bitch, he'd called her. Screamed the words at her. He'd mustered enough clarity to be ashamed of it. But the rage remained. Lysandra's eyes were wary, as if asking him, can we not, in this rare moment of happiness, speak as friends? Adian only returned to the fire, blocking out her emerald eyes, her exquisite face. Ren could have her, even if the thought made him want to shatter something. Lysandra and Evangeline vanished from the hall, the girl still chirping away. The weight of Lysandra's disappointment lingered like a phantom touch. Ren cleared his throat.
You wanna tell me what's going on between you two?
Adian cut him a flat stare that would have sent lesser men running.
Get a map. I want to go over the passes again.
Ren, to his credit, went in search of one. Adian gazed at the fire, so pale without his queen's spark of magic. How long would it be until the wind howling outside the castle was replaced by the baying of Erewhon's beasts? Adian got his answer at dawn the next day. Seated at one end of the long table in the great hall, Lysandra and Evangeline having a quiet breakfast at the other, Adian mastered the shake in his fingers as he opened the letter the messenger had delivered moments before. Ren and Murtaugh, seated around him, had refrained from demanding answers while he read. Once. Twice. Adian at last set down the letter. Took a long breath as he frowned toward the watery gray light leaking through the bank of windows high on the wall. Down the table,
The weight of Lysandra's stare pressed on him. Yet she remained where she was.
"It's from Killian,"
Adian said hoarsely.
"Morath's troops made landfall at the coast. At Eldris."
Ren swore. Murtaugh stayed silent. Adian kept seated, since his knees seemed unlikely to support him.
"He destroyed the city, turned it to rubble without unleashing a single troop."
Why the Dark King had waited this long, Adian could only guess.
"The Witch Towers?"
Ren asked. Adian had told him all Manon Blackbeak had revealed on their trek through the stone marshes.
"It doesn't say."
It was doubtful Erewhon had yielded the towers, since they were massive enough to require being transported by land. And Adian scouts surely would have noticed a 100-foot tower hauled through their territory.
"But the blasts leveled the city."
"Aelin?" Murtaugh's voice was a near whisper.
"Fine," Adian lied. "On her way back to the Orinth encampment the day before it happened."
Of course, there was no mention of her whereabouts in Killian's letter. But his top commander had speculated that since there was no body or celebrating enemy, the queen had gotten out. Murtaugh went boneless in his seat, and Fleetfoot laid her golden head atop his thigh.
"Thank Mala for that mercy."
"Don't thank her yet."
Adian shoved the letter into the pocket of the thick cloak he wore against the draft in the hall.
"Don't thank her at all,"
he almost added.
"On their way to Eldris, Morath took out 10 of Wendland's warships near Ilium, and sent the rest fleeing back up the Florine along with our own."
Murtaugh rubbed his jaw.
"Why not give chase? Follow them up the river?"
"Who knows?"
Adian would think on it later.
"Erewhon set his sights on Eldris, and so he has now taken the city. He seems inclined to launch some of his troops from there. If unchecked, they'll reach Orinth in a week."
"We have to return to the camp," Ren said, face dark.
"See if we can get our fleet back down the Florine and strike with Rolf from the sea, while we hammer from the land."
Adian didn't feel like reminding them that they hadn't heard from Rolf beyond vague messages about his hunt for the scattered Mycenaeans and their legendary fleet. The odds of Rolf emerging to save their asses were as slim as the fabled wolf tribe at the far end of the Anuskul Mountains riding out of the hinterland. Or the Fae who'd fled Terrasen a decade ago, returning from wherever they'd gone to join Adian's forces. The calculating calm that had guided Adian through battle and butchering settled into him, as solid as the fur cloak he wore. Speed would be their ally now. Speed and clarity.
"The lines have to hold,"
Rowan ordered before they'd parted.
"Buy us whatever time you can."
He'd make good on that promise. Evangeline fell silent as Adian's attention slid to the shifter down the table.
"How many can your wyvern form carry?"
Chapter 2. Elide Lochan had once hoped to travel far and wide, to a place where no one had ever heard of Otterlin or Terrasen, so distant that Vernon didn't stand a chance of finding her. She hadn't anticipated that it might actually happen. Standing in the dusty, ancient alley of an equally dusty, ancient city in a kingdom south of Doranel, Elide marveled at the noontime bells ringing across the clear sky, the sun baking the pale stones of the buildings, the dry wind sweeping through the narrow streets between them. She'd learned the name of this city thrice now and still couldn't pronounce it. She supposed it didn't matter. They wouldn't be here long. Just as they had not lingered in any of the cities they'd swept through, or the forests or mountains or lowlands. Kingdom after kingdom, the relentless pace set by a prince who seemed barely able to remember to speak, let alone feed himself. Elide grimaced at the weathered witch leathers she still wore, her fraying gray cloak and scuffed boots, then glanced at her two companions in the alley. Indeed, they'd all seen better days.
"Any minute now," Gavrielle murmured.
a tawny eye on the alley's entrance. A towering dark figure blended into the scant shadows at the half-crumbling archway, monitoring the bustling street beyond. Elide didn't look too long toward that figure. She'd been unable to stomach it these endless weeks. Unable to stomach him, or the unbearable ache in her chest. Elide frowned at Gavriel.
We should have stopped for lunch.
He jerked his chin to the worn bag sagging against the wall.
There's an apple in my pack.
Glancing toward the building rising above them, Elide sighed and reached for the pack, rifling through the spare clothes, rope, weapons, and various supplies, until she yanked out the fat red and green apple, the last of the many they'd plucked from an orchard in a neighboring kingdom. Elide wordlessly extended it to the Fey Lord. Gabriel arched a golden brow. Elide mirrored the gesture.
I can hear your stomach grumbling.
Gabriel huffed a laugh and took the apple with an incline of his head before cleaning it on the sleeve of his pale jacket.
Indeed it is.
Down the alley, Elide could have sworn the dark figure stiffened. She paid him no heed. Gabriel bit into the apple, his canines flashing. Adian Ashriver's father. The resemblance was uncanny, though the similarities stopped at appearance. In the brief few days she'd spent with Adian, he'd proved himself the opposite of the soft-spoken, thoughtful male. She'd worried, after Astrin and Vesta had left them aboard the ship they'd sailed here, that she might have made a mistake in choosing to travel with three immortal males, that she'd be trampled underfoot. But Gavriel had been kind from the start, making sure Elide ate enough, had blankets on frigid nights, teaching her to ride the horses they'd spent precious coin to purchase, because Elide wouldn't stand a chance of keeping up with them on foot, ankle or no. And for the times when they had to lead their horses over rough terrain, Gavriel had even braced her leg with his magic, his power a warm summer breeze against her skin. She certainly wasn't allowing Lorkin to do so for her. She would never forget the sight of him crawling after Maeve once the queen had severed the blood oath. Crawling after Maeve like a shunned lover, like a broken dog desperate for its master. Aelin had been brutalized, their very location betrayed by Lorkin to Maeve. And still he tried to follow. Right through the sand still wet with Aelin's blood. Gavriel ate half the apple and offered Elide the rest.
You should eat too.
She frowned at the bruised purple beneath Gavriel's eyes. Beneath her own, she had no doubt. Her cycle, at least, had come last month, despite the hard travel that burned up any reserves of food in her stomach. That had been particularly mortifying. To explain to three warriors who could already smell the blood that she needed supplies. More frequent stops. She hadn't mentioned the cramping that twisted her gut, her back, and lashed down her thighs. She kept riding, kept her head down. She knew they would have stopped. Even Rowan would have stopped to let her rest. But every time they paused, Elide saw that iron box, saw the whip shining with blood as it cracked through the air, heard Aelin screaming. She'd gone so Elide wouldn't be taken, had not hesitated to offer herself in Elide's stead. The thought alone kept Elide astride her mare. Those few days had been made slightly easier by the clean strips of linen that Gavriel and Rowan provided, undoubtedly from their own shirts. When they'd cut them up, she'd had no idea. Elide bit into the apple, savoring the sweet, tart crispness. Rowan had left some coppers from a rapidly dwindling supply on a stump to account for the fruit they'd taken. Soon they'd have to steal their suppers, or sell their horses. A thumping sounded from behind the sealed windows a level above, punctuated with muffled male shouting.
Do you think we'll have better luck this time?
Elide quietly asked. Gavriel studied the blue-painted shutters, carved in an intricate latticework.
I have to hope so.
Luck had indeed run thin these days. They'd had little since that blasted beach in Eelway, when Rowan had felt a tug in the bond between him and Aelin, the mating bond, and had followed its call across the ocean. Yet when they'd reached these shores after several dreadful weeks on storm-wild waters, there had been nothing left to track. No sign of Maeve's remaining armada. No whisper of the Queen's ship, the Nightingale, docking in any port. No news of her returning to her seat in Doranau. Rumors were all they'd had to go on, hauling them across mountains piled deep with snow, through dense forests and dried-out plains. Until the previous kingdom, the previous city, the packed streets full of revelers out to celebrate Samhuin, to honor the gods when the veil between worlds was thinnest. They had no idea those gods were nothing but beings from another world, that any help the gods offered, any help Elide had ever received from that small voice at her shoulder, had been with one goal in mind, to return home. Pawns. That's all Elide and Aelin and the others were to them. It was confirmed by the fact that Elide had not heard a whisper of Aneth's guidance since that horrible day in Eelway. Only nudges during the long days, as if they were reminders of her presence, that someone was watching. That, should they succeed in their quest to find Aelin, the young queen would still be expected to pay the ultimate price to those gods. If Dorian Havilliard and Manon Blackbeak were able to recover the third and final word key, if the young king didn't offer himself up as the sacrifice in Aelin's stead. So Elide endured those occasional nudges, refusing to contemplate what manner of creature had taken such an interest in her. In all of them. Elide had discarded those thoughts as they'd combed through the streets, listening for any whisper of Maeve's location. The sun had set, Rowan snarling with each passing hour that yielded nothing, as all other cities had yielded nothing. Elide had made them keep strolling the merry streets, unnoticed and unmarked. She'd reminded Rowan each time he flashed his teeth that there were eyes in every kingdom, every land. And if word got out that a group of Fey warriors was terrorizing cities in their search for Maeve, surely it would get back to the Fey Queen in no time. Night had fallen, and in the rolling golden hills beyond the city walls, bonfires had kindled. Rowan had finally stopped growling at the sight, as if they had trudged on some thread of memory, of pain. But then they'd passed by a group of Fey soldiers out drinking, and Rowan had gone still. Had sized the warriors up in that cold, calculating way that told Elide he'd crafted some plan. When they'd ducked into an alley, the Fey prince had laid it out in stark, brutal terms. A week later, and here they were. The shouting grew in the building above. Elide grimaced as the cracking wood overpowered the ringing city bells. Should we help? Gabriel ran a tattooed hand through his golden hair. The names of warriors who had fallen under his command, he'd explained, when she'd finally dared ask last week.
He's almost done.
Indeed. Even Lorcan now scowled with impatience at the window above Elide and Gavriel. As the noon bells finished pealing, the shutters burst open. Shattered was a better word for it, as two Fey males came flying through them. One of them, brown-haired and bloodied, shrieked while he fell. Prince Rowan Whitethorn said nothing while he fell with him, while he held his grip on the male, teeth bared. Elide stepped aside, giving them ample space while they crashed into the pile of crates in the alley, splinters and debris soaring. She knew a gust of wind kept the fall from being fatal for the broad-shouldered male, whom Rowan hauled from the wreckage by the collar of his blue tunic. He was of no use to them dead. Gavriel drew a knife, remaining by Elide's side as Rowan slammed the stranger against the alley wall. There was nothing kind in the prince's face. Nothing warm. Only cold-blooded predator, hell-bent on finding the queen who held his heart.
Please,
the male sputtered, in the common tongue. Rowan had found him then. They couldn't hope to track Maeve, Rowan had realized on Samhuin. Yet finding the commanders who served Maeve, spread across various kingdoms on loan to mortal rulers, that they could do. And the male Rowan snarled at, his own lip bleeding, was a commander. A warrior from the breadth of his shoulders to his muscled thighs. Rowan still dwarfed him, Gavriel and Lorkin too, as if even amongst the Fae, the three of them were a wholly different breed.
Here's how this goes, Rowan said to the sniveling commander,
his voice deadly soft. A brutal smile graced the prince's mouth, setting the blood from his split lip running.
First, I break your legs. Maybe a portion of your spine so you can't crawl.
He pointed a bloodied finger down the alley. To Lorkin.
You know who that is, don't you?
As if in answer, Lorkin prowled from the archway. The commander began trembling.
The leg and spine, your body would eventually heal.
Rowan went on, as Lorkin continued his stalking approach.
But what Lorkin Salvatore will do to you.
A low, joyless laugh.
You won't recover from that, friend.
The commander cast frantic eyes toward Elide, toward Gavriel. The first time this had happened, 2 days ago, Elide hadn't been able to watch. That particular commander hadn't possessed any information worth sharing. And given the unspeakable sort of brothel they'd found him in, Elide hadn't really regretted that Rowan had left his body at one end of the alley, his head at the other. But today, this time,
watch. See.
A small voice hissed in her ear.
Listen.
Despite the heat and sun, Elide shuddered, clenched her teeth, bottling up all the words that swelled within her.
Find someone else. Find a way to use your own powers to forge the lock. Find a way to accept your fates to be trapped in this world. So we needn't pay a debt that wasn't ours to begin with.
Yet if Aneth now spoke when she had only nudged her these months, Elide swallowed those raging words, as all mortals were expected to. For Aelin, she could submit, as Aelin would ultimately submit. Gabriel's face held no mercy, only a grim sort of practicality as he beheld the shaking commander dangling from Rowan's iron grip.
Tell him what he wants to know. You'll only make it worse for yourself.
Lorkin had nearly reached them, a dark wind swirling about his long fingers. There was nothing of the male she'd come to know on his harsh face. At least, the male he'd been before that beach.
No.
This was the mask she'd first seen in Oakwald. Unfeeling. Arrogant. Cruel. The commander beheld the power gathering in Lorkin's hand, but managed to sneer at Rowan, blood coating his teeth.
She'll kill all of you.
A black eye already bloomed, the lid swollen shut. Air pulsed at Elide's ears as Rowan locked a shield of wind around them, sealing in all sound.
Maeve will kill every last one of you traitors.
She can try,
was Rowan's mild reply.
See,
Aneth whispered again. When the commander began screaming this time, Elide did not look away. And as Rowan and Lorkin did what they'd been trained to do, she couldn't decide if Aneth's order had been to help, or a reminder of precisely what the gods might do should they disobey. Chapter 3. The staghorns were burning, and Oakwald with them. The mighty ancient trees were little more than charred husks, ash thick as snow raining down. Embers drifted on the wind, a mockery of how they had once bobbed in her wake like fireflies while she'd run through the Beltane bonfires. So much flame, the heat smothering, the air itself singeing her lungs.
You did this, you did this, you did this.
The crack of dying trees groaned the words. Cried them. The world was bathed in fire. Fire, not darkness. Motion between the trees snared her attention. The Lord of the North was frantic, mindless with agony, as he galloped toward her. As smoke streamed from his white coat, as fire devoured his mighty antlers. Not the immortal flame held between them on her own sigil, the immortal flame of the sacred stags of Terrasen, and of Mala Firebringer before that, but true, vicious flames. The Lord of the North thundered past, burning, burning, burning. She reached a hand toward him, invisible and inconsequential. But the proud stag plunged on, screams rising from his mouth. Such horrible, relentless screams, as if the heart of the world were being shredded. She could do nothing when the stag threw himself into a wall of flame spread like a net between two burning oaks. He did not emerge. The white wolf was watching her again. Aelin Ashriver Whitethorn Galathinius ran an ironclad finger over the rim of the stone altar on which she lay. As much movement as she could manage. Cairn had left her here this time. Had not bothered moving her to the iron box against the adjacent wall. A rare reprieve. To wake not in darkness, but in flickering firelight. The braziers were dying, beckoning in the damp cold that pressed to her skin. To whatever wasn't covered by the iron. She'd already tugged on the chains as quietly as she could. But they held firm. They'd added more iron. On her, starting with the metal gauntlets. She did not remember when that was, where that had been. There had only been the box then. The smothering iron coffin. She had tested it for weaknesses over and over. Before they'd sent that sweet-smelling smoke to knock her unconscious. She didn't know how long she'd slept after that. When she'd awoken here, there had been no more smoke. She'd tested it again then.